Can I put this to you, gentlemen? The tenor of songs about Gallipoli and the First World War has changed over the past few years. And for a couple of decades recently, all the great war songs like that one were to do with its futility. But would you agree that the mood has shifted, that we're not minimising the horror, but we are minimising the futility? We're wanting to acknowledge more that thousands of men fought and died for future generations. What's your impression of what's happened to Anzac Day?
I'm not really in a position to speak, to be perfectly honest. Before I arrived in New Zealand, my knowledge of the events were limited basically to a Mel Gibson film. It's not something that's terribly well known outside New Zealand.
That's an interesting point. It'll be well known to you though, Bernard. Do you sense that the mood has definitely turned in New Zealand?
Yeah, it's interesting. In my lifetime, the level of involvement of younger people in the commemorations has grown, so a lot of people want to know the stories, as much because there are no people around from that time to actually tell them directly. So we have to get involved with books and read newspapers and watch documentaries and that sort of thing. I think there's a lot of interest in it, as much as we try to reconnect with all the memorials we see around town, trying to understand the stories beneath them. But I think you're right. The tone of how it's commemorated has changed a lot over the years. Perhaps we're a little less enthusiastic, but also at the same point, a little less somber.
Okay. Let's ask expert opinion. Professor Glenn Harper, Massey University's Professor of War Studies and the author of a number of books about World War One, kindly joining us on the day before Anzac Day. Glenn, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim.
And thank you for coming on. A couple of things to ask you about. But first of all, you can see the increased Anzac Day attendances. What does it signify to you?
I think it signifies a number of things. I think it's this growing interest, which your panellist alluded to just before. It's also an appreciation now, I think, that military history is everybody's family history. There are very few families in New Zealand that have been unaffected by military conflict in the past. And I think there's almost hunger to understand, you know, what was involved and why these people went and what impact it had on the country. And I'm really surprised, being on Anzac Days now for over two decades, and the numbers keep growing, and the number of young people that come along is surprising, but I think indeed very welcome.
The glum futility that's reflected in songs, like the one we just heard from the Pogues, the Eric Bogle song, has that changed? I mean, first of all, you know, you are an expert on World War One. We have heard on the panel before about a disparagement of the reasons we went to fight for war. How futile was it in your view?
I don't think it was futile, and I think that was very much the message that was pushed in the 1960s and 70s by a number of misleading books. Probably the most famous one is a book called The Donkeys, which has a quote in it that says something like some German commanders are discussing, you know, what's going to happen in the coming offensive, and one of them says, we know the British soldiers will fight like lions, and the other one says Max Hoffman's supposed to say yes, but don't we know they're led by donkeys? Right. The actual fact that that was a made-up quote. It did have a source attributed to it, but historians searched for it, and just before he died, the author actually admitted he had made it up.
That
had a very powerful resonance during the 60s and 70s, and I think we are moving away from that. And I think we're moving away from the notion that it was a futile war. And I certainly hope so, because I think it's one of the myths that is still associated with the First World War.
Even though the planning, as you have said to us before, the planning was bungled and the entire exercise was not well planned.
Absolutely. It was a very slow learning curve right from the beginning. No side knew what was in store. There was this first modern industrialised war of industrialised nations fighting each other, and mistakes were made on both sides, and it was very, very costly. But I think the notion that it was all for nothing, I think that needs to be really consigned to the dustbin of history, because I don't think it was. Hugh Strawn, in a recent very good one-volume history of the war, concludes it was certainly not a war without meaning and purpose, and I firmly believe that.
Do you think, though, that we have learnt much from that horrible sequence of events that actually led to the war? Because that month of, was it August or September in 1914, when so much could have gone right, but it went horribly wrong.
Oh, Everything went wrong. There's this notion of a learning curve, or some historians call it a blood curve. It was a very slow learning process. And of course, as we know, 20 years later, there's another conflict. I think one thing that we've probably learned is that modern industrialized nations shouldn't wage war against one another, because it's going to be hugely costly. And soldiers and sailors, airmen, are not a resource that we can squander lightly. We need to think long and hard before we put them in harm's way.
I want to ask you one more thing. I know that you're having a busy time at the moment, and it's good that you can join us, because you've been quoted in the media today about the diet that did us no favours during the Gallipoli campaign.
Definitely. It's hard to believe that we asked our soldiers to exist on a diet of staple diet of bully beef and biscuits, which made up 99% of their meals, with some black tea thrown in, and then expect them to perform well. It was so deficient in so many vitamins and minerals, and they were all suffering for it by the end of that campaign.
So the original Anzac biscuits were nothing to write home about.
No, we need to be careful. The Anzac biscuits actually came after the Gallipoli campaign. We're talking about
the biscuits of the Anzacs, if you like.
The army biscuits, and I think the Australians had the best name for them. They called them concrete macaroons, because they were certainly jawbreakers, that's for sure.
Professor Glenn Harper, thanks for joining us today on the day before Anzac Day, on the panel with Steve McCabe and Bernard Hickey are with us. Steve, what's on your mind?
Well, I've been spending a decent amount of time at the cinema just recently. I've seen some fantastic films, ranging from the absolutely bizarre Grand Budapest Hotel, which I saw a couple of nights ago, and still don't fully know what to make of, because it was just an experience. But I had a very, very, very disturbing cinema experience several weeks ago. I went to a screening of Sabotage. It's going to be coming out shortly. It's a new Arnold Schwarzenegger film. And it was so dreadful, it almost put me off going to the pictures for life. It was absolute rubbish. I was very disappointed with it. And then I got an invite to see a film that's coming out in about a week and a half called Chef. It's a new film written, produced, directed by, starring Jon Favreau. And it's one of the loveliest films I've seen in quite some time. I took my wife and my daughter to see it, and we came out of the cinema, got in the car. I said, right, girls, what do we think of that? And neither of them could find enough good things to say about it.
Really?
Absolutely lovely. Thin plot about a chef who gets bad reviews, goes and reinvents his life with his son, and teaches his son to cook in the process. And, I mean, it's phenomenally sweary. There are moments when it verges on food porn, but from start to finish, it's just nice. It's one of the most joyful films I've had the pleasure of seeing in quite some time, and I enjoyed every single second of it.
Okay, it's just called Chef.
Just called Chef. It comes out, I think, May the 8th, I think it starts.
What's wrong with Arnold's movie?
Oh, where do you want me to start? It's just, I mean, it's got Arnold Schwarzenegger in for a start. It's cliche-ridden, it's badly scripted, badly plotted. The story is, I think there's a story. I didn't really pay much attention. It was that bad. Again, pornographic, but violent. Violence porn rather than food porn. Food porn I can actually quite enjoy. But this was just violence, gratuitous nastiness and violence. I talked to Sarah McMullen at the screening. She was nowhere near as unimpressed as I was. She was altogether more forgiving. I just thought it was dreadful.
Forgiving of Annie.
Yes, which really, I mean, we shouldn't encourage him, really. He'll only do more.
Quarter to five. Bernard Hickey, what's on your mind, please, Bernard?
Oh, I've been thinking about the anatomy of a news story these days. I've been in the economic commentary and media business for a wee while, and I was sort of surprised at how the Forbes online article got such traction over the last week. Yeah. There's partly the New Zealand thing of we're always asking people from overseas what they think of us. You know, you imagine Prince William and Princess Kate turning up at the airport, and the first question we ask is, so what do you think? But this Forbes online article really surprised me how it got such traction, given it was fairly exciting, but not necessarily grounded in a lot of reality. And it got traction, I think, because of the Forbes brand being stuck on it, when actually the Forbes magazine only has about 40 reporters now, and the column that created so much attention is produced by one of the contributors who don't actually get paid. It's one of these Huffington Post-style operations.
So it's kind of an op-ed column.
Yeah, and those who do get paid, and not all of them do, get paid by how many clicks they get on their articles. So the more exciting, the more clicks they get, the more revenue they get. It's one of the unfortunate side effects of the trends in online publishing these days towards lots of content, clickbait headlines, and no one being paid, not much at all for it.
But isn't he right in one sense? I mean, he may have analysed things wrongly, and we alluded before to the genuine immigration demand fueling the Auckland housing boom, you know, and he didn't take that into account. But isn't he right about the core idea of a day of reckoning that has to arrive with debt?
Yeah, he's right to remind us that our house prices are overvalued and our households have way too much debt, and that New Zealand as a whole has also got too much debt, at least the households do. But where he tripped up, I think, was to assume that that would necessarily create this day of reckoning. Because, as I've learnt over the last 4 or 5 years, and lots of Mintz guests have learnt, that if there is a condition which might create a day of reckoning, then the powers that be step in to make sure it doesn't happen. It's creating a moral hazard, but it's true. You know, we've had reserve banks and governments step in to make sure that markets don't fail, that banks don't fail.
Yes.
And we've had it happen in New Zealand.
The reserve... But can they quantitatively ease forever and ever? Amen.
Well, they're trying. They've certainly had a good go at it in America. They're on to the third version and counting. And whenever they try to remove it, something goes wrong. And even just in the last few weeks, we've heard that the new Federal Reserve chairwoman, Janet Yellen, say that she might not be putting up interest rates all that soon. And, you know, it just keeps putting back and back. But remember, you cannot underestimate the power of a central bank to print money, or for a government to intervene and to rescue whatever market it is that's about to collapse.
Paying per columnist per click, that's fairly invidious, isn't it? I mean, or at least insidious, because you will, the natural human tendency, as you yourself have said, will be to write shriller and shriller prose.
Yeah, and Jesse Colombo's trick, if you like, is to go around pointing at countries and saying, you're a bubble, you're about to burst. And he's gone around a good chunk of the globe pointing the finger. And it worked. He got a massive traffic for a similar warning about Singapore. He says his next warning is about Israel. And
has he got the schedule, has he?
Yeah. No, he's got the map on the wall, and he's got a bunch of bubbles, and he's got the dartboard, and he's going around. And you know what? I sort of sympathise with him, because, you know, someone has to come out and say, actually, a lot of these asset markets are overvalued, and they could fall. And you can't just rely on them going up forever. But then again, we have seen over the last 5 or 6 years, central banks and governments have intervened at every step to make sure that Minsky moment never happens.
But can I just ask, what is so bad about media outlets, whether it's online or in print or on the airwaves, trying to enhance their readership, viewership, listenership? I mean, I grant you, the model you're talking about, where basically you lead to naked clickbait, is very, very easily quantifiable, and the amount that I'm going to pay you for your article is going to be totally determined by the number of inbound links that you generate. I mean, that's very, very easily done. But surely, larger newspapers with larger circulations will pay their staff more. Newspapers want to have sensational headlines to get people coming and reading their papers. Surely this is not new. And why are we singling out websites as being particularly cynical, when we've always known that the content aggregators make the money, not the content generators?
I suppose Bernard's point is that Forbes isn't quite the magazine it used to be, and this is almost an amateur contributor. Well, he's obviously not an amateur in terms of knowledge, I don't mean that, but he's an amateur contributor not getting paid. And in order to get paid or to generate any income, he's got to write this way. I suppose that's the difference.
Yeah, but he, one way or other, he's going to get paid. And you know, okay, the model is particularly skewed in that direction on the online model, but that's journalism in general. I mean, that's life in general. That's what we do.
What has happened, though, is that Forbes has used its brand and has leveraged off it to try and drive traffic, and in a way is devaluing the currency by doing this. And you're right, you know, the Sun newspaper and all sorts of tabloids have used sensational headlines to get sales in the past, and, you know, even in New Zealand that may have happened. The trouble is that you do that for long enough and you devalue the currency.
Most of them, the argument within the newspaper industry is that we make the front page like that, you know, to drag the customers in, and at least there's the responsible stuff in the middle. You don't expect to have the shrillness right through a publication.
It becomes more intense when the only way you can sell the newspaper or sell the online article is through the headline or the front page.
Yeah.
And after a while, people notice that they've been tricked. It was a bait and switch.
I'm going to be watching Hive News for headlines like economy wrecked.
Yeah, well, actually, the whole point of whether it's a subscription or whether it's a oncer, whether you buy it because you think the headline looks good, is a really important point for journalists. If you've got a publication which is based on an ongoing relationship with your audience, which is sustained by regular payments, that makes the business of sensational headlines sort of pointless, because eventually you'll erode the trust of your audience. And that's a big question for newspapers. How much of your publication revenue comes from subscriptions, and how much comes from sales at the dairy, and if you're online, how much comes from clicks from the middle of nowhere from a social network?
Yeah, it's a dilemma you wouldn't want to be facing at the moment in that industry, would you? One more question about Shane Jones's departure, an aspect we didn't quite get to yesterday. Minor developments today. The Greens have taken a swipe at him, calling him sexist and saying he won't be missed when he departs politics next month as Labour moves to contain the fallout. And Mr Jones had said it would be a long day in hell before he served under Russell Norman if Dr Norman were Deputy Prime Minister. The NBR sums this aspect of things up, and just your view, really. Nationals being accused of using the resources of the state to give it an advantage in its electoral competition. Traditionally, such appointments as Mr Jones's new one are termed patronage and can be used either to benefit a party's supporters or buy off opponents. And Gordon Campbell, the journalist, makes this argument. MFAT now operates as the minister's personal fiefdom and as a political fund, and reportedly the role being designed for Mr Jones will be at ambassadorial level. And so he's saying it's a cynical exercise. What would you call it? Do you have as harsh a view of what has happened with, you know, Ms. Murray McCully's offer to Shane Jones? How do you view it?
Well, I think Gordon Campbell's being I don't know what the right word is here, catastrophizing considerably. I think he's taking this word ambassador extraordinarily literally. I mean, I know that the new title the guy's got is Pacific Economic Ambassador, but ambassador to where? You know, he's talking about diplomatic status and credentialing. But this guy's not an actual ambassador. He's not a member of the diplomatic corps any more than, say, UNICEF goodwill ambassadors include people like Selena Gomez and the Wiggles. That's the level at which he's an ambassador. You know, the entire Manchester United Football Club is a UNICEF goodwill ambassador. If that's the level at which an ambassadorship is being given out. So I think somebody's latched onto this one word and gone, there you go. I'm not going to bother reading the rest of it. Too long, didn't read.
Did we make an offer to the Wiggles to tour the Pacific? I didn't know.
No, that was UNICEF. That was UNICEF. Altogether higher status.
Bernard, how seriously do you view... I mean, do you... What?
No, I want to see the details of whatever agreement comes out between Mr. McCully and Mr. Jones, if it is done. And but there is a history of this sort of political appointment to senior diplomatic roles. The High Commissioner's office in London is regularly filled by former speakers of parliament and the likes, and ambassador's position in the United States is currently held by a former prime minister of the Labour version, from memory, or has been in the past. So I'm not too hung up about political appointments to diplomatic roles, but it'd be nice to see the details of this, given that this is a brand new role and seems to have been created especially for Mr. Jones.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that will be nice to figure out is was this position advertised, as public positions generally tend to be? Could we have applied for it? Could I have nominated you, Jim, for example?
Sounds like a great trip. I mean, the Pacific can be a fun place to travel around.
Research shows most New Zealand women are failing to meet Health Ministry nutritional guidelines when they're pregnant. Figures from a longitudinal study of more than 5,000 women by Auckland University found only 26% were eating 6 daily servings of vegetables and fruit. And etc. research like this is reasonably regular. We'd just like to finish by talking about a phenomenon that we're all aware of and which we applaud or decry according to our instincts, either the gradual loss of our freedom to self-determine or the gradual benign attempts by the state to improve our intractable behaviours. And I wouldn't mind your comments, because there's you mentioned a book, an important book before, Bernard, and here's one, a new one called Social Physics by MIT data scientist Sandy Pentland, arguing that by analysing data from smartphones, social media, credit card systems, we'll soon be able to have a mathematical understanding of the basic mechanisms of social interactions. So social scientists will be able to understand and predict the interactions of people the way physicists understand and predict the interactions of objects. So government, business, will create incentive systems to tune people's behaviour, making society more productive and creative. They'll just keep nudging and nudging us. Is this the future?
I think it's fascinating how big data is becoming part of our lives, because we're creating this big data with particularly our phones and our use of social media to essentially advertise where we are at any point of the day and what we think and who we connect with and all sorts of things. And this idea of using big data to social engineer is something that we haven't really thought about much, but certainly the tools are there now. And the position of chief algorithmist could be the most powerful one on the planet at some point.
Chief algorithmist. Is this the future you want?
Ooh, well, it's kind of creepy because as you say, Bernard, you know, we're willingly giving up all this information. We're choosing to hand it over. And if you read the two articles that Jim sort of nicely munged into one here, what we're seeing is that what you're calling big data, Bernard, I would say it's very little data. It's tiny, tiny little data teams that are being accumulated together to form a big picture. Big governmental pushes, as we've seen in the issue of pregnant women not getting the right nutrition, aren't working. When you have official announcements, you must do this, doesn't work. When you get, as we've seen, these very, very tiny nudges into certain behaviour, when the subliminal, we don't even know they're happening, we're remarkably pliable. We're very biddable.
Don't the big ones work? You know, give yourself breathing space on the roads. Never go more than 104 k's an hour. That's just sinful. Let's quietly shun the smokers. Let's berate fat people. I mean, doesn't some of that, quite a lot of it, work?
No, I think stuff that you are told on a very high processing level doesn't sink down into your psyche very easily. Stuff that goes in that doesn't require high level processing is more likely to become part of your behaviour.
Okay,
you do it subtly.
All right, but do you nevertheless think it's the future? Let's nudge everyone into behaving well.
Absolutely,
it's you could have like a Facebook nudge.
All right, so that's the onslaught.
It's coming.
Okay. And the book, again, is called Social Physics, if you're interested. Bernard Hickey, I hear the music. Thank you very much for coming on.
Cheers.
And Steve McCabe, you too.
Thank you very much.
Have a lovely long weekend, everybody, and a great observance of Anzac Day tomorrow as well. We are back Monday. Thanks very much.